Now time for a catch up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, Uzbekistan courts international tourism and attempts to silence the barking dogs of Toronto. But first we go to London, where this weekend the first coronation of a British monarch in 70 years took place, with King Charles III crowned as the sovereign in a formal ceremony at Westminster Abbey in London. The coronation of his late mother, Queen Elizabeth II, took place there in 1953. It's estimated the event will eventually have cost more than £100 million. That's about €113 million, which will be paid for by the British taxpayer. But it has also provided a boost to the country's economy, as Russell Padmore reports now from London.
The coronation of King Charles in Westminster Abbey followed traditions dating back almost 1,000 years to the time of William the Conqueror. The ceremony featured royal tradition, pomp and pageantry, with the new monarch and the Queen Consort Camilla wearing crowns covered in jewels worth millions. The service was conducted by the Archbishop of Canterbury. The priceless crowns and royal procession in a golden coach, cheered on by huge crowds, highlighted how expensive the bill for taxpayers will be. But despite the cost, the British economy is on course for a major boost, which could be worth more than €1 billion. An extra holiday for Monday means a boost for the entertainment and leisure sectors. Licensing hours for bars have been extended. Last year, the celebration of the Platinum Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth provided bumper takings for pubs and restaurants, part of an estimated €6 billion generated for the economy. London's tourism industry is enjoying increased numbers of visitors, and many hotels were fully booked weeks ago. To encourage businesses to produce souvenirs, the royal family relaxed restrictions on the use of the official crown logo, created by Sir Johnny Ive, the former chief design officer at Apple. Luxury goods makers have been cashing in for months by launching specially designed products to mark the occasion, from watches to commemorative plates and cups. Association with the royal family is a good marketing strategy, giving brands an air of tradition linked to a long heritage, which appeals to consumers who value authenticity and quality craftsmanship. Royal weddings or births, and of course this coronation with its media coverage, can generate interest in luxury products, bringing new customers long after the event. Some of the items I've seen for sale include silver cufflinks and expensive watches. King Charles is renowned for wearing cufflinks, and his mother, Queen Elizabeth, wore an expensive watch at her coronation in 1953, which gave a boost to its manufacturer. The auction house Sotheby's also marked the coronation by holding a special royal-themed sale, with items like a letter written by Mary, Queen of Scots, or a 1950s replica set of the British crown jewels going under the hammer. The royal relaxation of rules governing use of the official crown insignia included the condition that merchandise must be in good taste, but opinions on that can be divided. I've seen picture frames on sale for selfie portraits with King Charles already in them, so all you have to do is add a snap of yourself. Shops have also been selling themed balloons, a coronation table flag, and face masks with the image of the king. More tacky than tasteful, perhaps. The estimated cost of more than £100 million for the coronation here in London comes as people struggle to cope with the cost of living. The crowning of King Charles III also comes amid divisions in the royal family and a stream of negative publicity surrounding the exile of Prince Harry in America. A recent survey by the polling group YouGov revealed that 1 in 3 do not like Queen Camilla. And more than 25 years since her death, Princess Diana is still more popular than her former husband and the monarchy in general. According to recent research by Statista, 2 in 3 people support the monarchy here. But a future worry for the newly crowned King Charles is that only a third of young people aged 18 to 24 support having a royal sovereign as head of state. The coronation was a chance for people to enjoy the colourful pomp of a rare historic event, and despite the cost, it should bring a big boost to the British economy. And King Charles has already started to slim down the cost to taxpayers of funding the royal family. As the golden coach slowly carried King Charles back to Buckingham Palace, past cheering crowds, the monarch would have been well aware that a new and challenging era for the royal family has started. Charles famously met Bob Dylan backstage at a concert in the mid-1990s, an awkward conversation with a singer who had been very critical of the extravagant lifestyle of the royals. One of Dylan's biggest hits was "The Times They Are A-Changing," a message that applies very well to the reign of King Charles. I'm Russell Padmore in London for World Report.
Next we go to Uzbekistan, a place which was once closed off to tourists. Set in the heart of the Silk Road, the ancient trading route between China, the Middle East and Europe, the country's new leadership is now actively welcoming international travellers, as Petula Martin reports.
The ancient city of Samarkand evokes exotic images of the Silk Road. Located in the northeast of Uzbekistan, it was one of the most important sites along the trade route traversing Central Asia. Merchants led camel caravans over mountains and deserts to trade goods in the bazaars of Samarkand, a crossroads of world cultures. The Silk Road, a well-worn path that connected China and the Middle East and Rome for 1,500 years, it's now considered off the beaten track. "You're going where?" was one of the most common questions ahead of a recent trip to Uzbekistan. The former Soviet Republic has long been a holiday destination for Russian visitors and neighbouring Kazakhs, but it's opening up to the world and wants to attract more international travellers. Citizens from all EU member states no longer need a visa to visit Uzbekistan after the visa regime was liberalised in 2016 when President Shavkat Mirziyoyev came to power. The pandemic set tourism back globally, but this year Uzbekistan is hoping to exceed its pre-pandemic numbers by welcoming 7 million international tourists. That's good news for our guide Saeed of Silk Road Destinations, who has never had a group of all Irish visitors, not to mind a group of all female visitors. He practices and perfects his English while explaining to us the historical significance of Registan Mosque and Madrasas, one of a number of UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Samarkand. In Uzbek, he tells intrigued locals that his group of tourists are from Irlandia. They nod and smile. "Our presence is welcome, and our Instagram selfies, which help showcase their beautiful ancient city, are appreciated." We learn about Amir Timur, who conquered West, South and Central Asia in the 1300s. His patronage of architects and artists made Samarkand the cultural hub it still is today. We learn about his grandson, Ulugh Beg, an astronomer who built an observatory in Samarkand and composed a catalogue of 1,018 stars. Samarkand was once the centre of the known world, capital of the Temurid realm. The influence of another power is also evident in Uzbekistan, obvious in its very name. It's one of the Soviet stans. The country came under Russian control in the 1800s and emerged as an independent state when Soviet rule ended in 1991. The Soviet influence is evident in the roads and railway stations across Uzbekistan. A devastating earthquake destroyed much of the capital, Tashkent, in 1966 and was rebuilt over 3.5 years. Signs were erected on buildings under construction saying, "To the people of Tashkent, from Moscow. To the people of Tashkent, from Ukraine." More than 1 million square metres of housing, schools and administrative facilities were built at the time. The capital's metro stations are so ornate they're a must-see for visitors to the city. One of the most striking is the Kosmonautlar station, lined with ceramic medallions depicting Soviet cosmonauts, including Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, and Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space. From the rubble of a natural disaster, the modern city of Tashkent emerged. After Tashkent, we are brought to Bukhara. We visit a building called Chasma Ayub, which means the Well of Job, famed in the Islamic and Christian traditions for his patience. Our guide Saeed tells us that legend has it that at a time of prolonged drought, Job reached Bukhara and locals asked for his help. He began to pray, struck the ground with his stick, and a spring of fresh water appeared in its place, bringing salvation. On the day we visit, locals fill bottles with water from the well at Chasma Ayub. The water is believed to be healing. Uzbekistan is a doubly landlocked country, and so water is precious. Chasma Ayub also houses a water museum, which documents the story of the Aral Sea. The Aral Sea was so vast that it was called a sea, when in fact it's a lake, and was once the fourth largest lake in the world. In the 1960s, the Soviet Union undertook a major water diversion project on the arid plains of Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. Two major rivers that fed into the Aral Sea were used to transform the desert into farms for cotton. It devastated the Aral Sea. It's now 10% of its former size. The environmental disaster draws dark tourism. People visit the villages that were once fishing communities to see the rusted boats in what is now desert. Late last year, USAID launched the second phase of funding, $1.6 million, to counter the adverse effects of desertification at the Aral Sea. We leave the Water Museum at Chasma Ayub and think how wonderful it would be if patient Job could return and perform another miracle. For World Report, this is Petula Martin in Bukhara, Uzbekistan.
Finally, to the city of Toronto in Canada, where authorities have removed some signs at city-run parks that concern their pets, dogs especially. The signs went up in a bid to have dog owners limit the barking of their dogs because it disturbed residents who live close by. It seems the signs had little effect on the owner's ability to comply and even less influence on their canine friends. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it seems Toronto isn't the only jurisdiction grappling with the issue.
The sign at one downtown Toronto park read, "Due to the closeness of the area residents, do not allow your dogs to bark and disturb the neighborhood." That was the St. Andrew's Dog Park, a playground just for canines. The sign also read, "Excessive barking will not be tolerated." Toronto doesn't have a city noise bylaw that specifically targets the prohibition of excessive barking, but it does have a noise bylaw, in which a person can be fined up to $500 for sound that exceeds permitted levels outdoors, or for making, causing, or permitting noise that is unreasonable and persistent. The city says the signs were put up to, quote, "balance the needs of a range of park users and local communities," and is to remind users of the off-leash area to be considerate of nearby residents. It added, although barking is expected at off-leash areas, excessive barking can be disruptive to neighbors. The sign also calls on dog owners to be responsible and follow all posted off-leash area rules. Unfortunately, the dogs themselves could not read the signs, didn't understand them, or just ignored them. For many dogs, often cooped up for long periods while their owners are away at work, and who are then taken to these dog parks, it's a chance to run free, jump, play, socialize, and yes, even bark. Residents and dog owners also expressed mixed reactions to the regulations, mulling over just how one is to keep his or her dog from barking. Something as natural to canines as speaking is to humans. Some people even encourage their dogs to bark. There are plenty of online tutorials and instructions on how to keep your dog from barking, even the suggestion of devocalization, which is opposed by the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association. Another sign at another downtown park read, "Please be respectful of the neighbors and deter your dog's barking." Again, no instructions are offered on just how to do that, neither for the dog or the owner. One dog owner on social media said he understands completely that dogs bark while in play, but adds that some owners spend their entire park visit looking at their mobile phones while their poor canine friend is barking nonstop trying to get their attention. Another user writes that there is definitely a bias against dog owners, saying that marketing material for a condominium nearby shows the building is next to a dog park. So what can the residents expect? Some municipalities, however, have taken the issue more seriously. The city of Hamilton, down the road from Toronto, has increased the fines it can lay against dog owners whose canines repeatedly bark up a storm. That city is taking off the gloves, with a maximum fine of $25,000 for repeat offenders. A few years ago, Hamilton was dealing with about 600 noisy dog complaints every year. Alleged offenders could get a visit from animal control officers immediately following a complaint. The city can now issue a fine in a way similar to a parking ticket. The animal control officers will first try to educate the dog owners and offer tips on how to get them to behave. The dogs, that is. One bylaw officer said, "We give them a warning, some solutions, but if the problem persists and the neighbors have had enough, we look at charges." London, Ontario is looking at a similar solution. Some dog owners are concerned that these animal control officers are also checking for pet licenses, which some owners don't have, and that disputes between neighbors could escalate and wind up with animal control being called as retaliation. In Norfolk County, in southwestern Ontario, the Ontario Provincial Police have begged people to stop calling police about barking dogs. They say their officers respond to numerous complaints, despite online forms that can be filled out to properly report on noisy pets. But in Norfolk County, barking isn't the only complaint officers have had to deal with. Police have received emergency calls about kids not wanting to do the dishes, homeowners complaining about raccoons, and even one person calling 911 because they couldn't decide what to watch on television. Some might suggest that those who misuse emergency services and waste taxpayer dollars are barking mad. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.